So tonight I want to talk about mudita. Mudita roughly translates, it's one of those Pali words that doesn't translate that well. It's sympathetic joy, which means the joy you experience when you encounter other people who are happy. This is one of the Brahma Viharas. The noble abodes I mentioned last week when I talked about compassion. This is the another of those, and it's said in the Theravada tradition that if you have a heart full of loving kindness with metta, which is yet another of the Brahma Viharas, if your heart is full of loving kindness and you encounter happiness in the world, you will naturally feel joyful. That's the natural response of a heart filled with loving kindness, encountering happiness in the world. So I want to talk about that, but I want to talk about it from the point of view of yes, but to start with, like, how come this doesn't seem to be my always experience? Maybe it is for you, but certainly for me, there's moments of joy and moments of not so much. First of all, I want to point out that the Buddha was known as the Happy One. That was one of the names that people called him by. He just seemed to be joyful all the time. And encouraged others, in many places in the sutta, he encouraged others to cultivate joy. And so the first question you might want to ask, why do I need to try to be joyful? Isn't joy something that just sort of arises naturally, spontaneously? That's a common misconception. Unfortunately, for most of us, most of the time, that simply isn't true. We all experience joy sometimes. But there's a lot more out there that we can take in if we start to cultivate. So I want to look at the word cultivate itself. What does cultivate mean? Webster's dictionary has three related definitions of the word: to encourage, to foster the growth of. I like that. And then the one I like the most is to prepare or prepare and use for raising of crops. Which is like, I'm a gardener, so that's naturally this appeals to me, right? But it's actually quite a useful analogy, this idea of cultivating crops. And let's look at this idea of cultivating crops in the context of right effort, the sixth step on the Eightfold Path. To prepare a field to grow things, or a garden bed, or a little pot for that matter, with some dirt in it, first of all, you have to take out all the big stones and pull out all the weeds that are there. You have to sort of clean things up before you even start. And this is the first part of right effort, which is, to prevent unwholesome mind states from arising, and to get rid of unwholesome states that have already arisen. So that's sort of like weeds and rocks. There's weeds and there's rocks in our minds that we have to somehow learn to clear up. We've got to clear the way. We'd like to think we're naturally joyful, but actually, often the opposite is true. Part of this is purely biological. We're sort of programmed at some sort of basic brain stem level way to look out for trouble. Our instincts for self-preservation are very powerful and very strong. Because 10,000 years ago, if you'd lived in Colorado, well, maybe I don't know. I think there were people in Colorado then, but we would have been like in small, tiny, clan-like groups, and there'd be a lot more big, nasty animals and other nasty people, for that matter, who w would be out for us as a meal or just to sort of this take what we have. And so we had to instinctually be very vigilant. And this is like built sort of like built into our DNA. Like we had to always sort of like be on the lookout. You know, is something coming to eat me? Is someone coming to attack me? So we always have instinctually we always have our guard up, looking for trouble, essentially. The mind tends not towards joy. The mind, the tendency of the mind is towards fear and aversion. That's what's built in. That's how we're wired, in a sense. And then our culture keeps reinforcing this with all the negative advertising and bad news. You know, every ad we ever see tells us we're not good enough. That if we, you know, we need to buy product X and then we'll be good enough, we'll be cool enough, smart enough, sexy enough, whatever enough, that we're not right now. So we keep getting reinforced into believing that things aren't okay. And then the news media sort of wallows. I use the word wallows intentionally in the negative, you know, in all the unpleasant, horrible things that are going on in the world. And I'm not saying that they shouldn't do that, but there doesn't seem to be a lot of balance. It tends to be, I mean, it's much, news is much juicier if it's about something bad. Basically, is how it works. And that's how the news organizations operate. They always, you know, have that sort of doom and gloom thing about this dangerous, undependable world that we live in. So the first thing we have to do to cultivate joy is to understand this, to see that that's the case, that we are hardwired to look for problems, and that what we consume, mentally consume on a daily basis is more negativity that reinforces this. So we have to sort of, you know, dig out the rocks and pull out the weeds. This takes a lot of effort. This is what right effort, why the Buddha put such emphasis on right effort. He was making it one of the thing it steps on the Eightfold Path. It takes we can't sort of just assume that, oh, everything will be okay. This doesn't work that way. You know, there's a I want to read you something. This is from this wonderful little book called This Is Water by David Foster Wallace. And he's talking about this he's actually talking about this as part of a commencement address to a bunch of students who are just graduating from college. You know, so they're 22, they're full of energy, they're graduating, and he's going to talk about this, which is, I'm sure it was like, oh God, what's this guy talking about? But it's a quite a brilliant way he does this. And he's talking about this sort of the automatic reactive mind. And I'm sort of picking up in well into the middle of his little discourse. If you're automatically sure that you know what reality is and who and what is really important, if you want to operate on your default setting, then you, like me, will probably not consider possibilities that aren't pointless and annoying. But if you've really learned how to think, how to pay attention, then you will know you have other options. It will actually be within your power to experience a crowded, hot, slow, consumer hell type situation as not only meaningful, but sacred, on fire with the same force that lit the stars. Compassion, love, the subsurface unity of all things. You get to, oops. Not that this mystical stuff is necessarily true. The only thing that's capital T true is that you get to decide how you're going to try and see it. This, I submit, is the real freedom of real education, of learning how to be well adjusted. You get to consciously decide what has meaning and what doesn't. You get to decide what to worship. It's a great word, how he's, because here's something else that's true. In the day-to-day trenches of adult life, there's actually no such thing as atheism. There's no such thing as not worshiping. Everybody worships. The only choice we get is what to worship. And an outstanding reason for choosing some sort of God or spiritual type thing to worship, be it JC or Allah, be it Yahweh or the Wiccan Mother Goddess or the Four Noble Truths or some infrangible set of ethical principles, is that pretty much anything else you worship will eat you alive. If you worship money and things, if they're where you tap the real meaning in life, you will never have enough. Never feel you have enough. It's the truth. Worship your body and beauty and sexual allure, and all you will always feel ugly. And when the time and age start showing, you will die a million deaths before they finally plant you. On one level, we know all this stuff already. It's been codified as myths, proverbs, cliches, bromides, epigrams, parables, the skeleton of every great story. The trick is keeping the truth up front in daily consciousness. Worship power, you will feel weak and afraid, and you will need ever more power over others to keep the fear at bay. Sound like someone we know? Worship your intellect, being seen as smart, you will end up feeling stupid, a fraud, always on the verge of being found out, and so on. Look, the insidious thing about these forms of worship is not that they're evil or sinful, it's that they are unconscious. They are default settings. They're the kind of worship you just gradually slip into day after day, getting more and more selective about what you see and how you measure value without ever being fully aware that that's what you're doing. And the so-called real world will not discourage you from operating on your default settings, because the so-called real world of men and money and power hums along quite nicely on the fuel of fear and contempt and frustration and craving and worship of self. Our own present culture has harnessed these forces in ways that have yielded extraordinary wealth and comfort and personal freedom. The freedom of all to be lords of our tiny, skull-sized kingdoms, alone at the center of all creation. This kind of freedom has much to recommend it. But of course, there are all different kinds of freedom, and the kind that is most precious you will not hear much about talked about in the great outside world of winning and achieving and displaying. The really important kind of freedom involves attention and awareness and discipline and effort and being able to truly care about other people and to sacrifice for them over and over in myriad petty little unsexy ways every day. This is real freedom. And he goes on, but that's, so you see what he's getting at here, of course, is if we can choose to cultivate joy. We can choose to approach life from in a way such that joy will arise more often, or we can just fall on our default settings, which tend towards not joyfulness, tend towards, being worried, being afraid, being averse. So then the second part of right effort comes into play here. Once we've sort of pulled out the rocks and weeds, right? So the second part of right effort can be applied to create the conditions where wholesome mind states can arise and to preserve these mind states once they have arisen. Going back to our analogy about preparing the field, we have to churn the soil, add fertilizer, plant the seeds, water the plants when they sprout. This is the practice of mudita, of sympathetic joy. This is what we do. There's a wonderful poem. This is a poet named Rabindranath Tagore. And this poem, I keep coming back to it because I love it so much. This is called Friends. And it sort of exemplifies mudita in a way I can't explain. It was in May. The sultry noon seemed endlessly long. The dry earth gaped with thirst in the heat. When I heard from the riverside a voice calling, "Come, my darling." I shut my book and opened the window to look out. I saw a big buffalo with mud-stained hide standing near the river with placid, patient eyes, and a youth knee-deep in water calling it to its bath. I smiled amused and felt a touch of sweetness in my heart. That's a good description of mudita. Just this totally common everyday thing, but just there was something about it that moved him, and then his heart opened. I felt amused and felt a touch of sweetness in my heart. It's a very great description of mudita. So, how can we do this? How can we practice being more joyful? How can we actually make this a practice? Which is, if you're familiar with Buddhism at all, everything's a practice, right? The whole of life is a practice. So this is how do we make our life a practice where that leads to more joy? Well, first of all, we have to understand, we have to have right understanding that what we usually think of as something that's going to make us joyful, make us happy, doesn't work that well. It fails on many things. Like no matter how much we acquire, as David Foster Wallace was pointing out, no matter how much we acquire, how much praise we receive, how much status we gain, it's never enough. It's never enough. It just doesn't work as a method to make ourselves happy. Which of course, and this is of course exactly what our culture tells us to do to make ourselves happy. Which is a big problem in a way. But let's look at how this works. We think of something we want, whether it's, something like a bowl of ice cream or something like, more status or more money or to be famous or whatever, you pick your thing you wish for. Well, the whole time you don't have it yet. The whole time you're wishing you had it. Are you happy? No. Then you actually get, if you're lucky, you actually get what you were wishing for. At that moment, sure enough, you're happy. I finally got that bowl of ice cream. I've been thinking about it all day, or whatever. Yeah. That, and I can't deny for 1 minute that the actual moment of getting something, whatever it is you wanted to get, that at that moment is like, oh, this is great. Joyful. And then, because whatever that thing was, it's subject to the laws of the universe, it's going to go away eventually. Maybe, you know, the bowl of ice cream is gone just like that. Oh, no, no, that was nice, but now what am I going to do, you know? Or it could be, you know, some longer term thing, like you get that new job and you go to the new job and then you go, about a year into the new job, you go, God, these people are horrible and I don't really like working with them and what am I doing here? You know, all that joy you felt in the beginning is gone now because things have changed. Because as they always do, things are always changing. So instead, if you want to cultivate mudita, sympathetic joy, all you have to do, it's really simple, actually. I love this teaching because it's so simple in a way. It's just look around at what you see in the world around you. You know, you're just, you know, going about your daily business. And maybe you go by a playground and there's some kids playing in the playground. And they're laughing and they're running around. And you know how little kids can be really just like joy buzzers, right? So, or you're, just see someone walking their dog. You ever seen, I often notice when I go and I see someone walking a dog, how happy the dog looks too. Not only is the person happy, they're getting some exercise and they're with their best friend, but then the dog, you see these dogs that smile, right? Like, they're just like full of joy, these dogs, and their tails are wagging and they're just having a great time, right? Or you just see someone who's just sort of sitting on a bench, especially today because the sun was finally out after a couple of days of rain, just sitting there, they're not doing anything, they're just sunning themselves. They look pretty comfortable and have a little smile on their face maybe, and they're just loving that energy of the sun. Or you see a couple walking by hand in hand and they have that sort of couple energy, that blissful couple energy going, you know, and you can feel it 10 feet away, right? And all you have to do is tune into any of those things. Just let that joy that's there all around you all the time, just take it in, feel it, and just be happy simply because you're seeing other people happy. You're experiencing the joy all around you. But you have to be very conscious of this. This has to be something you practice, right? Because often we're caught in envy when we encounter happiness in others. The opposite is sympathetic joy. Instead of being happy, seeing other people being happy, you know, we complain about how noisy those kids are. Oh, those kids are so noisy. Or we worry that the dog owner walking along isn't going to stop and pick up the poop, right? Oh, they're just going to get more poop in the sidewalk. You know, that's where our mind goes. Or we see the person sitting on the bench and we go, oh, boy, that person ever lazy. They should be doing something useful. They're just sitting there in the sun. What's wrong with them? They're so lazy. Or you see this couple walking along looking blissful and you go, oh, that won't last. I'll give them 6 months max. And you know, that's where our minds go. Often, that's where our minds go. So how can we cultivate this? And there's Within the Theravada tradition, all of the Brahma Viharas have formal practice methods. And for mudita, just like the other Brahma Viharas, there's a phrase you can repeat. And the phrase is, may your happiness continue, may it increase. So you encounter someone who's happy, and you wish them that their happiness continues. Not only does it continue, that they get more happiness. This is very heart opening. Instead of being caught in the opposite, we just tune into what's around us, and then every time we encounter someone who's happy, we wish them more happiness. That's all there is to it on our day-to-day living in the world basis. Just see it and then offer this wish that they have more. And they don't have to know you're wishing. That's totally irrelevant. It's your heart we're working on changing. Your heart, you're developing the habit of seeing happiness around you and wishing whoever's experiencing that happiness, they should have more. It's that simple. And that creates this joy. This joy becomes more, it becomes a habit, a wholesome mind habit. I did a long retreat once. I'll share a little experience. I did a long retreat where, so this is a 40-day retreat, and so I was going to do 10 days of each of the four Brahma Viharas. So I'd done 10 days of metta, and then I'd done 10 days of compassion practice, karuna, compassion practice, which is, I'll be honest with you, difficult. Because basically you're tuning into the sorrow, the difficulties of the world, all day long, from when you wake up to when you go to sleep. And it was hard. I was interesting, and I struggled with it. But it was okay. The best I can say is okay. It certainly wasn't like, oh boy, this is so much fun, right? And then I woke up after 10 days of compassion, so it was time to switch to mudita practice. And I just, in the mudita practice, the first thing you do is you think of someone you know who's really joyful. One of those, people. We all know people who just seem to always be happy. These people, right? And you just picture them in your mind, and you start wishing them more happiness. May your happiness continue, may it increase. So here's this person. So you're filling your mind with the thoughts of this joyful person and wishing that they have more. And so I just started doing this. I got up at 5 in the morning, like I was doing, and after breakfast. So, and the first morning said, so what? This is about 10 o'clock in the morning. So I've been practicing this for about 5 hours or so. And then I went to see my teacher, because it was a day when I had an interview, what's called an interview with the teacher, where you go and have a private meeting with the teacher. And I sit down in the chair opposite him, and I have the biggest smile on my face. And I'm sitting there, and I can't stop giggling. It's hard for me to even get two sentences out without having just a sort of a giggle about everything. Everything is just like, and all I did was change my mind state for a few hours. Now, at this point, this is 20 days into the readout, I was quite concentrated, so I was really going at it in terms of being very precise and not, I was staying with it. But it was like this huge lesson in how powerful mudita is. Just after 10 days of going, oh God, compassion, huh? Okay, yeah. Now it's just like this other thing was happening, and I was just like blissed out. I had 10 days like that. It was like 10 days of just like everything was wonderful. It was really an interesting 10 days to see how powerful that energy can be. in a, when you're really concentrating on cultivating it. But it's not always the case. Sometimes you try and cultivate this, and instead, what's called the far enemy of mudita arises. So all Brahma viharas have far enemies and near enemies. So the far enemy is the opposite of, right? And what arises when you see someone joyful, sometimes if you're not careful, is envy. You start thinking, it's not fair. They're so lucky. How come I'm not so happy? How come they're so happy? This person I'm thinking about who's happy all the time, how come I'm not like that? It's not fair. It's like somehow the world is supposed to be fair, right? That's a big problem right there. But or even if they are so happy, there's no way I can be. It's like, and now you're thinking, that there's sort of this limited amount of joy in the world, and if they have a whole bunch, then you're going to get less. Like somehow joy is in limited supply. But this is where our mind goes. This is envy speaking. Or you can even get into the, they don't deserve to be that happy. They don't deserve it. You start focusing, because you start, instead of focusing on their joyful personality, the joy that you see in them, their wholesome qualities, you start focusing on all their unwholesome qualities. They do blah 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 sometimes. I've seen them, I've heard them, and now you're caught in the opposite of joy. This is the tendency of our mind, so we have to be aware of this. All of these things I've just, all these examples I just gave are examples of what's called comparing mind, where our habit is always to look at others in the context of ourselves. I'm better than them, I'm worse than them. You either put them down or you put yourself down. There's no joy in either of those. As soon as you fall into comparing mind, that's just cuts joy at the root. Once again, this is something our culture encourages us to do all the time. Look at those people over there who are, you see an ad and they're all dancing and having a good time in a bar or something, or they're on the beach and they're having, little drinks with umbrellas brought to them in their beach chairs or whatever, whatever it is. And we that that's we say, oh, they look like they shouldn't really be there, or whatever, one of these envious mind states arises. Even the thought, and here this is a little trickier. I'm talking about comparing mind. Even the thought, I'm equal to them, can be unwholesome, because it reinforces the idea that somehow I'm separate from them. And what we're trying to do with all the Brahma Viharas is cultivate this energy of no separation. We can feel joyful because they're having joy over there, because there's no, they're not separate from me. There's no separation at all. That's where we're headed with this practice. And comparing, no matter in what form, I'm better than, I'm worse than, I'm equal to, creates a sense of me, not me. I'm automatically fallen into this thing. In traditional teaching, this sort of mind is called conceit, which I think is actually quite a good word. A conceit in the sense of, I think I'm separate. What a conceited thought. And I reinforce it by comparing mind, by me, not me, being reinforced by I'm better than, I'm worse than, I'm equal to. Once again, very much against the way our culture thinks and operates. That's okay. The other extreme, there's another extreme we also have to watch for, and that's called the near enemy of mudita. If envy is sort of dark and gray, the near enemy is of mudita, of sympathetic joy, is over exuberance. You know, when we are in a state where we feel wonderfully sweet, but we've lost our balance, we've gotten giddy. I think it's a good word for this energy. And it's okay to be giddy for a few seconds. You know, you're laughing with a friend or something like that. But when it becomes your mode of operation in the world, it becomes overly sweet. It starts to lose grounding in the real world. You're not seeing things as they really are anymore. You know, this is... I can say this because this is where hippies operated, having been there myself. It was like the whole hippie ideal was basically, it's all love, man. It's all cool. You know, let's get stoned. Okay, that was like the whole world operated, right? And it was like, it was over exuberant. There was no grounding in the real world at all. Sweet, marvelously sweet sometimes, but not grounded. So neither of these, neither envy nor overexuberance, have to be there. Right? If we can practice mudita consciously, and then be mindful. Ah, here's mindfulness again. Be mindful of our mind state so that when we see those unwholesome mind states of envy and overexuberance arising, we can go, oh, gone off the edge here. And then I can shift back to just wishing whatever I experience more happiness, a shift. This is also, by the way, a great way to deal with people you don't like, people you have difficulties with. If you can take someone who you have real difficulties with and instead wish that their happiness not only continues but increases, it just shifts your mind about this person. It's called, all the Brahmaviharas have this idea of working with what's called a difficult person. It's very interesting to do this because if you're wishing them well in this way, wishing them more happiness, it's pretty hard to be grumpy about them at the same time. It's just, you can't, the two mind states just don't fit together. So it's a way to shift those relationships at the mental level, so you don't fall into that habitual pattern of grumpiness around these people. One of the uses of mudita in a more personal way. So what I'm suggesting is that we can actually consciously choose to practice such that joy arises more often in our lives, and that we can overcome with practice the hardwired tendencies of mind towards doom and gloom, worry. You know, they're just mind states. And all we're doing is we're sort of trying to reset our defaults, to use techie terms. I was on an old computer guide one time. So Just we're hitting the button. We're hitting the reset button over and over and over and over and over again to reset it from worry and fear to joy, happiness, seeing the happiness all around us. It's like we're tending our mental field. To go back to the word cultivate again. It's like our mind is like a field, a mental field, and we're cultivating that field to be aware of joy, to feel joy, to be okay being joyful. That's a tricky one, actually. Some people have real difficulty with mudita because it's like, oh, I can't let myself feel this good. Because, for whatever reason, I shouldn't feel this good because what happened 5 years ago, or I'm still dealing with that, or the world is falling apart. How can I let myself be joyful? Boy, if you've ever been around someone who's happy all the time, it's such a great thing to do just to be around joyful people. It's like if you ever, it just uplifts everyone around them. Just that's what we're trying to do. We're trying to become sort of beacons of joy. We're trying to become spreaders of joy. We're trying to feed joy into the world. The more joy we experience, the more we naturally spread it around to others. Happiness is contagious. It's one of those very contagious mental states. If you're around people who are happy, you just, if you let yourself, you happiness just arises more and more and more. And you can become literally a radiator of joy. Wouldn't it be a nice thing to be? I think it'll be a radiator of joy. What a wholesome idea to decide to be. And it's just a matter of consciously choosing to do so. And then working hard at the practice. And not beating yourself up when you realize, boy, I haven't radiated much joy today. Oh, I've been really grumpy. Then accept that. That's okay. Just be mindful of that. And then just see if you can see something, some little thing that happened during the day. Or you look out the window and you see the birds at the bird feeder. Or, someone walking their dog or whatever it is. The smile on your cat's face, because cats are very smiley, whatever it is. And just tune into that, tune into that energy, and joy will come. One more thing to read here. This is, I'd forgotten, totally forgotten about this poem, and I was thinking, what poem can I read at the end tonight? And I was thumbing through this book, one of my favorite Dharma poetry books. It's called Go In and In by Dana Faulds. And there's a poem right near the end called Stardust. It's a pretty joyful poem. So, Stardust. From a crowded firmament of constellation, a galaxy reaches out to stroke my cheek with a single spiral finger. One star speaks. Life is not a test. There's no key to find or door to open. Self-improvement is not the point. There's only awakening. And one day you will all awaken to the rapture of the great lovemaking, when the heart of everything is revealed to as you. When the myth of separation is burned to ash in the searing flame of truth, a lifetime of forgetfulness erased in an instant of remembering. The beloved enters, takes me in a whirl of tenderness and bliss. In that moment, two are one, and one is everything. The stars and souls are whole, unbroken, flowing motion. What is wrapped in skin or cloth, in form, has no birth or death or destination. The star speaks to me again. The seeds of love are sown. The seeds of love sown an eternity ago are blossoming now. Let me read that again. The seeds of love sown an eternity ago are blossoming now. There has always been divinity, and this at last is who we are. Love in endless consummation. Love without limitation. It's the truth. Then with a rush of wind, like countless wings, I'm left to sit in stillness with the taste of stardust swept upon my lips. Wow. This is describing a major mudita moment quite wonderfully, I think. The merit of our practice. May the beneficial energies arising from our practice here together today become the causes and conditions for the end of suffering and the awakening of all beings everywhere.
Everyone have a good night tonight.
Thank you, Kim.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks for joining us, Valerie.